We've come to the third and final of the Dhamma talks for this retreat, of the main Dhamma talks. Now, obviously most of you are here, at least the ones that are actually sitting here, most of you are here, mostly, at least in body. I know there were a couple of people who said that they weren't going to be able to make it to tonight's talk, so I asked if they could, if the talk could be recorded. Is that going to happen? Yeah? Okay, good. Thank you so much for that. So if there's anybody who's missed out on tonight's talk, because I did kind of arrange the talks in a sequence, so I'm kind of building up to the great, this is the third act, this is the great kind of climax of everything tonight, so if you missed out on tonight, then you've really missed out. Anyway. So, where were we? Oh yes, metta meditation. So, we decide we want to meditate. We go, we find somewhere to meditate, we sit, close our eyes, establish mindfulness, be aware whatever's happening. Thoughts, feelings, memories, sensations, intentions. As we become aware, we come into the present moment, we become established on what is actually happening. And when we feel reasonably aware, then we begin the meditation itself. We begin practicing loving kindness. May I be happy. May I be happy. We build a solid and careful foundation for the meditation through applying ourselves, using the words of loving kindness, with mindfulness, with attention. And this creates a strength in our in the way that we're paying attention. It creates a strength in our meditation. Our mind starts to be not so wandering around here and there. We've got a determination, a resolve. This is where our mind's going to be directed. This is the intention that we will be developing. As we continue with that, reminding ourselves of that wish that we have, that wish to be happy, then somehow, magically, as if from nowhere, the spark of loving kindness arises. How does it happen? Where does it happen? Why? Who knows? Somehow it's there. And when that spark comes, when that warm glow of loving kindness happens, we hold that, keep it close, keep the feeling of loving kindness carefully nurturing it. As we continue with the words, may I be happy, may I be happy. And then as that feeling becomes more clear, more strong, more steady, more reliable, we spread it out through the whole body, like water spreading through a cloth. Or like the simile the Buddha gave of a lotus that's growing underneath the water. And even though the lotus is growing completely immersed in the water is saturating through every part of that lotus. So in the same way, we bring that metta, bring that loving kindness through and soak it through every part of your body, every cell in your body. And hold that like a whole body image. I don't know if you've ever seen a Buddha image made of glass or crystal. And sometimes when you see a Buddha image made of glass or crystal, if you imagine that lit from behind by a candle, So you can see that whole, the body of the Buddha glowing. Yeah? So you meditate until you can see it's like your whole body is glowing from within with that soft light of loving kindness. And you can feel, you can like picture, you have an image in your mind of your whole body like that. And this is what we call the, I mentioned the other day, the Ugaha Nimitta, the preliminary sign. And if you sustain that for maybe 20, 30 minutes or so, that stage of meditation, for those of you who are familiar with the traditional meditation vocabulary in Theravada, that's equivalent to what we call the Kanika Samadhi. It's a short-term concentration. Sometimes they translate it as momentary concentration. Well, that's not really a good translation, but more like short-term or temporary concentration, Kanika Samadhi. So that lasts for maybe 20, 30 minutes, and if that's going well, then we proceed to the next stage of metta for a loved person. Yeah? And keeping our mind as it is, keeping that image of the body, we introduce a name of a loved person into the words of metta. Not moving over there, not thinking about where that person is or thinking about them, not imagining them or visualizing their face or anything like that. Sometimes those things happen anyway, yeah? Maybe an image of them comes up or whatever. It's not important. The important thing is to keep the awareness with the feeling of metta. That's the important thing. Remember, metta is a feeling meditation. The feeling is the important thing. Everything else is just about trying to help bring that feeling up, focus on it, develop it, bring it to fulfillment. That's all that the meditation is. So if we do that, the second stage of meditation, we try to develop that until the metta we feel for that loved one and the metta we feel for ourselves is equivalent. If we feel that's easier to develop the metta for the loved one, then we can start with them, we develop that, and then bring it back to ourselves. Either way, we do it so that it's the same. You can move from one to the other without it making any difference. So the boundaries between oneself and one's loved ones are dissolving. Now, if we can complete that, then it's time to move to the third stage of metta, which is loving kindness for a neutral person. And we go about that meditation exactly the same way as loving kindness for the loved one. You think beforehand of one neutral person, okay? So you have to choose just one. Remember, there's about 7 billion neutral people on this planet. You don't have to do each one individually, all right? So a neutral person doesn't mean somebody who you have no feelings for one way or another. It just means somebody who, you know, you don't have really strong feelings of either like or dislike for. Usually it would be somebody who you're familiar with to some degree, but you don't know all that well. Often a good choice is to use somebody who you might meet at the BF. Yeah? Somebody you run into once a week and you say hi and exchange a few words with them, but you're not like close friends or anything like that. Or maybe it's someone at work, maybe someone you say hello to down at the local shops or whatever. Okay? So it's somebody who you're familiar with. You should know their name, know them well enough to talk to, but not somebody who you have kind of any strong kind of feelings of connection with one way or the other. And then that's your neutral person. And just as with the loved person, there are a few counterindications. So somebody with a neutral person, also there are some counterindicated neutral people. And that is because the Buddha said that neutral feeling is the counterpart of ignorance. Right? That means that when when the mind, when there's no particular strong or negative feeling in the mind, you tend to get bored and fall asleep. Yeah? Isn't that right? Yeah? So when you have some strong, pleasant feeling, you're sort of, you know, stimulated and you want to wake up with that. If you have a very strong negative feeling, also, you know, it keeps you awake. If there's nothing, just grey and blank, like some of us experienced during the meditation retreat, and too much neutral feeling, then your mind tends to fall asleep. Yeah? So the Buddha said that ignorance is the counterpart of neutral feeling. So, for this neutral person, don't choose anybody that's too ignorant. Okay, don't choose somebody who's very stupid. Don't choose somebody who's crazy. Don't choose somebody who's like a drug addict, or somebody who's really lazy and just sleeps around all day. Yeah. So all of these things are on the side of ignorance and delusion. And if you choose somebody who's has those qualities, then that will tend to promote those qualities when you do that third person, so it won't be very wholesome. So you want to choose somebody who's kind of reasonably kind of normal and so on. And you develop that metta for them exactly the same as you did for the second person and for yourself, keeping the feeling in your body, not shifting or changing attention very much at all, keeping, just introducing the name of the neutral person and keeping the attention there. Now, usually, it's not too difficult to do loving kindness for the neutral person, okay? Usually, there's no special challenges there, except that sometimes you can have a tendency to fall asleep, yeah? Because of that same thing, because it's a neutral person, so you tend to get bored. You don't really care about them, right? So if it's a hated person, you can't stop thinking about them, right? But if it's a neutral person, as soon as you don't really care whether they're happy or not, actually. That's what the definition of being neutral is, yeah? You don't really care about them. So mind tends to get to fall into sleepiness. And what can happen is you fall into a state that sometimes in meditation circles they call bhavanga. And what bhavanga is a state of, another word they use sometimes is moha samadhi, is like delusion concentration. So that's where you lose mindfulness and the mind slips into, it's almost like a sleep or dream state. And it actually can be quite peaceful. So the thing with bhavanga is that it actually is, there's no, not necessarily any thought, yeah? There's no mind still and quiet and so on, but there's no awareness, there's no mindfulness. So bhavanga itself isn't harmful, it's actually quite restful, but it doesn't really get you anywhere in terms of your practice. So if you find that this is happening, sometimes your mind will slip down into a state of sort of subliminal awareness and can stay there for a long time. You can actually sit for long periods of time. Some people can sometimes mistake that for samadhi and they think they've been sitting in samadhi for a long period. In fact, they're just sitting in bhavanga. So the difference is whether there's awareness in the mind, whether you clearly know. So if you find this is happening to you, if you find you're sort of slipping down into a subliminal state, and you need to come back out of it, wake yourself up, start with the metta again, build up the feeling of rapture and joy, and especially the quality of rapture, what we call piti, is that uplifting quality I've spoken about in a few of the talks. That quality especially brings the interest. So if there's a lot of rapture, then there's a lot of interest, and that's what will tend to keep the mind engaged with the object. Okay, now if we assume that third stage goes okay, which usually there's not too much problem with that, then we're ready to start the fourth stage of metta, which is the disliked person. Of course, doing metta for the disliked person is the most difficult part of doing metta meditation. I'm probably not going to be wrong if I say that for many of you, it'll be the most difficult thing you've ever done in your life. It is a real challenge. And when you come to that stage, you realize how, you know, you can have been sitting there doing metta and being a good Buddhist and keeping precepts, and I'm not even squashing an ant, you know, and I've been doing all the right things for so many years. And then suddenly that moment comes, and my goodness, the demons that are lurking there in the mind. It's quite amazing. And when you're in the metta meditation, then you'd think that the metta would mean that the hatred you feel for that person is, you know, reduced and so on, which of course often it is. But when you focus on that person solely in the meditation and your mind is like zeroing in, then suddenly any even like residual kind of aversion or anger that you have, it sort of just comes, it feels so strong. And so it can actually rip your mind completely out of the metta, and you can feel just full of hatred and anger in just a few seconds. All of that work that you've done is just thrown out the window. That's how powerful it is. Yeah, you're getting to the roots of it. You're revealing this actually is the strength of these underlying tendencies. And they stay there for years, and they can be there and we don't suspect how strong they are. And then all of a sudden, they can come up. It might not come up as strong as that for you, but it does for some people. And I just mention it so that if you do this and then this happens, then you don't think that you're doing anything wrong. No, it's not that you're doing anything wrong. It's just that's revealing to you. That's how powerful the mind is. Yeah? And that's why we take such a gradual approach to this meditation. That's why we're not rushing it. Okay. Now, over this very short retreat, I'm introducing you to these different stages, but I don't really expect you to be, you know, to be developing fully any of these stages. It's just to show you what it involves. That's all. You know, actually, you need to take your own time. Yeah? Take as many weeks, as many months, as many years as you need to develop each stage, okay, before moving on to the next. But I'm just doing this as an example so you know where the practice is leading. Actually, probably be better just to, we just do the first stage of metta for the whole retreat, actually. That's probably the best thing to do. That if you do a retreat like that, everyone's like, well, is that all there is? Yeah. But also it's useful because, you know, after I go and, you know, if you keep practicing, then, you know, some of you will want to progress and will go to these different stages. And so it's, you know, you need to know what it involves. So, okay, when you come to that disliked person, so again, when you're choosing the disliked person, you need to think of one person who you find annoying. It doesn't have to be like an arch nemesis, okay? It doesn't have to be somebody who you want to kill and murder and rip their limbs apart and stomp on their limbs and condemn them to the lowest level of Avicii hell, okay? It doesn't have to be like that. It might be just somebody who you find annoying. Somebody who you find gets on your nerves. Somebody who's just, you know, you have that kind of anti-chemistry with. You know, some people you have a chemistry with, you automatically get along with them. Some people you have an anti-chemistry with, and you automatically get annoyed with them. Yeah? So something like that. So think of them before the meditation, but think of them very quickly and then stop thinking about them. And that's the hard part, yeah? Because normally once you thought of them, because the mind plays tricks, doesn't it? Because you think, you think a thought about them. Okay, I won't think about them. And then you think a very nice thought about them. Because you're a nice person. So you only think nice thoughts. And then you think a thought, oh, that was really nice when they did such and such the other day. Huh. It was good. Bit surprising, considering. You know, for them, that was actually a pretty good thing to do, actually. Yeah. Yeah, not like last week. Yeah. And then your mind, you go around that thought and it comes back in little bit by little bit, and before you know it, yeah, the anger comes back full on. So you have to use your mindfulness very quickly. Don't think about that person at all. And you should have been training yourself from the beginning in this, okay? Remember, I've been saying this right from the beginning. So for example, even if you talk, if you're doing meditation for the loved person, okay, I don't want you to be sitting there thinking all of the nice things about that loved person, okay? Now do you understand why I don't want you doing that? Because you need to learn how to cut through that thinking. Because it's all very well to sit there and think nice things about the loved person, but then when you get to the disliked person, you're going to follow that same habit and you're going to think all about them. And then that's going to completely destroy your meditation. So you need to go beyond that. You come back to that feeling. You come back to that feeling of metta. And that feeling that you've developed for yourself, for the loved one, for the neutral person, and for that disliked person. That feeling is the same. Yeah? And you keep on your focus back on that feeling. Now, in that fourth stage of loving kindness, you're so close. You're so close to having completed that task that we've set ourselves. The mind, it's like the mind almost like smells that the goal is near. It's almost like the mind becomes almost like an animal that's instinctually leaping towards the goal. And it discards everything else and starts to become very one-pointed, very unified on that feeling of metta. As long as it doesn't get ripped out by the thoughts about that disliked person, the natural inclination is the mind will gather a tremendous energy and go for that. Quite different from on the third stage where the energy was quite low, there wasn't the kind of the negative thoughts, but there also wasn't the enthusiasm. In this fourth stage, as long as the negative thoughts don't come in, then the mind will have this great enthusiasm because you realize this actually is what I've been wanting to do all along. If I can love this person just as I love anybody else, then there's no being in this whole cosmos, this whole 10,000-fold world system that I can't love if I can love this one person. And so the mind has like this intuitive recognition of this, and it leaps with an energy towards that goal, and the one-pointedness starts to come in, and the mind starts to become very unified. Now, what's happening here is that the five jhana factors are starting to become fulfilled, and I'm going to come back now and talk about those five jhana factors and talk about how they have been developed in this meditation, because you've been developing those five jhana factors right from the beginning of the meditation, okay? So the five factors of the first jhana, which you should all know, vitaka, vichara, piti, sukha, ekagata, okay? Vitaka, initial application of mind, or perhaps best just application of mind. Vichara is sustaining of the mind. Piti is rapture, or joy, or uplift. Sukha, pleasure, bliss. Ekagata, unification. Okay, I'm going to talk a little bit more about what each of those factors means, and then I'm going to talk about how they apply in the metta meditation. So the vitaka, the literal meaning of vitaka, often you'll find in the suttas that the word vitaka is used in the sense of thought. And so you'll often find it actually translated as thought. Okay, so it'll say, you know, the bhikkhu enters in the first jhana which has thought and examining or thinking and pondering or something like that. And it gives the impression that you're sitting there in jhanas thinking about things. No, that's not the case, all right? It's a very misleading translation. Jhanas are states of altered consciousness. The Buddha called it adi citta, is like the higher mind. And everything in the state of jhana has a different meaning than what it has in a normal state of consciousness. Okay? So, for example, the word piti or rapture, like in a normal, everyday conversational Pali, okay, piti has a meaning of excitement about something, yeah? But excitement is not what it means in the context of jhana. Yeah? Sukha has a meaning. Normally, the most common meaning of sukha is like a kind of sensual pleasure, yeah? The pleasure you get from sex or the pleasure you get from eating nice food or something. But the pleasure that you experience in jhana is quite different from that. It's much more refined. So everything in jhana, in these states of altered consciousness, has a different, more subtle and more refined meaning than it does in the ordinary everyday language. Okay, so we have to understand that. So the Buddha, of course, did as he only could. All he had available to him were the words that were used around him in the everyday language. So he used those words, but it's made clear in many contexts that they're used in a different sense than they are in everyday language. So the word vitakka is closely associated with the idea of thought, but the actual specific meaning, the more subtle and refined meaning in the context of jhana, is the application of the mind, like the placing of the mind onto the object is the vitakka. Okay? So in the breath meditation, the object is the breath. And so placing the mind onto the breath. In the metta meditation, the object is the feeling of metta. So it's like the placing of the mind onto the feeling of metta. The vichara, normally in everyday language, the word vichara means exploration, wandering about. Yeah. So you could literally translate the first jhana as, say, the bhikkhu thinking and with his mind wandering enters into the first jhana, right? It's obviously exactly what it doesn't mean, right? It's exactly the opposite meaning. Vichara, in the context of jhana, means... It's actually explained in the Abhidhamma as anusandhanata, which literally means sustained application, a sustained connection, anusandhanata, sustained connection. So that vitakka is placing the mind and vichara is keeping it there. Yeah? And so there's this like rhythm, this kind of gentle rhythm, almost like, you know, you think of the waves on the shore, you know, where the vitakka is like the wave coming into the shore, and then when the wave comes in, it stays there for a while. The vichara is when it stays there for a while, and then it kind of recedes a bit, and then the vitakka applies it again, the wave stays there for a while, it's the vichara, and then it recedes a bit. And so it has that kind of dynamic. So that's the meaning of vitakka vichara in the first jhana. And the Buddha described it using a simile of a ball of soap powder. So as if you have a ball of soap powder which is soaking all the way through with water and you're kind of kneading it. A bit like you're kneading dough or something like that. So you have a kind of a lump of bread dough and you're kind of kneading it and it's moist all the way through. The moisture is the feeling of bliss, the feeling of sukha. And the kneading of it is the vitakka vichara. Okay, so it's still, you know, you think about that image, it's still self-contained, right? If the mind isn't scattered here and there, it's not wandering around there, everything's self-contained, but there's a kind of a rhythm within that. Yeah, this sort of subtle squeezing rhythm within that. This is the kind of massaging. So that's vitakka vichara. Piti, I've talked about earlier in the talks, piti is a sense of rapture or uplift. Now, what piti is a positive emotional response. Okay? So piti is a positive emotional response. Okay? Thrill, excitement. Yeah? In everyday language. In meditation, the kind of piti that we're looking for is called parana piti. It means pervasive rapture. And it's like a very, very subtle sense of uplift. A kind of very subtle zing or zest that you feel through your body that gives like a it gives a spirit to the meditation. Yeah, is the piti. Sukha is like the other side of the piti, whereas piti is closely associated with energy and with uplift. Sukha is closely associated with tranquility. Yeah? So sukha is the settling side of pleasure. These are like two different aspects of the experience of pleasure. One aspect is the uplifting part of it, and the other aspect is the settling part of it. So the sukha is the settling part, like the sweetness of the pleasure. And the final one of the five jhana factors, ekagata. And they usually translate ekagata as one-pointedness, which is a very unfortunate translation. And I find myself by mistake using the word one-pointedness purely because of lack of mindfulness. So if you ever hear me saying the word one-pointedness, you just need to just mentally cross it out, okay? And say unification instead is a better word, okay? So what ekagata means is that place where everything comes together as one, right? Is what we call ekagata. And actually ekagata is a synonym of samadhi. Okay, so unification and samadhi use basically the same meaning. Right? What does it mean when we say unification? Okay, well, there's a number of different aspects of that unification. Okay, one aspect is that it's a unification of consciousness. That means that instead of the six sense consciousnesses, you only have one sense, one consciousness, which is the mind consciousness. Okay, no seeing, no hearing, no smelling, no tasting, no touching. Mind only. That's one aspect of the unification. The other aspect of the unification is that it's unification in time. That means that there's no past and no future. And if there's no past and there's no future, is there any present? Maybe we'll let the philosophers worry about that. But there's certainly, you know, when we say, you know, be in the present or be in the present moment, okay, when you're in your meditation, it's like, I feel that I'm here now in the present, and I know that there's something maybe in the future and there's something in the past. And if I want to remember the past or imagine the future, I can. So I'm in like a present moment which is balanced between the past and the future. Okay? With unification of mind, the mind is completely still over a long period of time. There's no waves in consciousness anymore. It's just still. And so because it's still for such a long period of time, there's the idea, the very existence of the past and the future, they're just not there anymore. The present is no longer something which is balanced between the past and the future. The present is all there is and all there ever has been. This is why when like mystics and so on gain these experiences, they come out of it and they say, I've experienced the infinite, I've experienced the absolute, I've experienced God, I've experienced eternity. Because in that space, it's true, it is actually infinite, it is eternal. There's no time, there's no change within that space. Okay? So this is that unification in time. Yeah. The other sense of unification, of our one-pointedness, is a unification in terms of a balance of all things. And that means that everything, especially these five jhana factors, are all present, they're all full and complete, and they're all in balance with one another. Okay, so everything is there that needs to be there. Everything is working perfectly. And this is one of the defining qualities of a true experience of samadhi, is that it feels completely natural. Yeah? The Buddha contrasted real samadhi with a kind of false samadhi, which he called a samadhi which is forcibly held in place with restraints. Okay? This is a kind of the migraine samadhi. Yeah? I'm going to hold my mind. Yes, I've got it there with me. Okay? That kind of samadhi, which I think many of us are quite familiar with, yeah? And that's a kind of artificial samadhi. It's where you're holding it in place. So this is a natural samadhi. Everything just is there. Everything is as it should be. It is like you have come home for the first time. It's like a revelation. This is how the mind is supposed to work. It's like you've been driving a car for all your life with smoke belching out the back and backfiring and the gears won't work and the brakes are dodgy and so on. And then finally, someone, mechanic, takes pity on you and fixes up your car so that it drives properly. And you realize, oh my goodness, that's actually how a car is supposed to work. I had no idea. Yeah? That's how it was supposed to be all along. And you realize with the five hindrances gone, That's how the mind works. It's completely natural. So that's these five jhana factors. Now, hopefully you can begin to see how these apply when we're developing the metta meditation. Yeah? When we're starting, we're developing the words of metta. Yeah? May you be happy, may I be happy, or may you be happy. And so through the applying the mind with those words of metta, we're developing the vitakka. Ultimately, we'll leave the words themselves behind. I'll come to that in a minute. But in the meantime, we're developing it by using those words. And if the bringing up the words is the vitakka, and the evenness that we say them with, yeah, the consistency that we bring to it, then this is developing your vichara. Okay, so again, this is why I've been emphasizing this throughout the development of the meditation, that to keep these words there, to keep them even and consistent and steady, that is how you're developing your vitakka and your vichara, yeah, the strength which is underlying the meditation. Then the feeling of metta comes up, the piti, the rapture. Yeah? If your vitakka and vichara is well developed, then when the rapture comes up, it will last. It will be sustained. It will be strong. It will be stable. And it will be suitable for a basis for samadhi. But if your vitakka vichara is not well developed yet, then when the rapture comes up, it will be feeble and it will be short term and it will just go away. So this is why we put that work into developing that vitakka vichara first. Then the rapture comes up. Typically, when we're developing metta meditation, the rapture arises relatively quickly. Of course, this is very personal. Yeah? And we've heard through the interviews that there are many different experiences and people respond to the meditation in many different ways. But on the whole, we tend to have the rapture arises relatively fast as compared, say, to breath meditation, when it can take quite a long time for the rapture to arise. Yeah? So in this, the rapture tends to arise quite quickly, but it tends to be not so subtle, not so refined. So it's more of a kind of gushing or kind of over-emotional rapture. And so our job then is to tranquilize that down, bringing up the feeling of bliss, the sukha. And so that's the tranquil aspect of pleasure. These two aspects of the pleasant experience, the exciting, uplifting aspect is the rapture. The settling aspect is the sukha. So we need to balance those two. And when all of those are together, when all of those qualities are present, when all of them are there in the right amount, when they're all working together in harmony, then this is giving rise to the final one of the jhana factors, the ekagata, or the unification. And that is what is starting to arise at this fourth stage of loving-kindness meditation. We've done metta for oneself, a loved one, a neutral person, metta for that disliked person. The mind hones in, focuses in on that. And the concentration becomes much stronger. The awareness of your body will start to drop away. So previously, we've been developing the feeling of metta in the body, like consciously bringing the feeling into the body and integrating it in the body. That's still the case, but what happens now is that because the concentration is becoming very strong, it's like your body is becoming transformed and the feeling of metta is like shining through it. And so you can't actually see your body anymore because the feeling of metta is so strong. It's something which is hard to describe, but actually when you experience it, it's very natural. It's not like you're being separated from your body. It's like you're seeing through it more deeply and more clearly than you ever have before. And so your body starts to disappear. The sounds will start to disappear. The thoughts, you have very, very few thoughts. And the mind will sort of start to gallop towards its object. It becomes more and more eager. Sometimes you can get very excited. Yeah. Sometimes the mind can get too thrilled. Yeah. And then the samadhi will deteriorate. You get too excited, too disturbed. And so then it comes back and you have to start again. So once you reach that fourth person, you really want to stay there as long as you can. Okay? Don't be in a hurry and don't leave it too early, right? If the alarm goes and you have to go off to work or whatever, just say, I don't care whether I keep my job, I'm going to do my meditation. Okay, just keep on going there. And if you get to work and the boss complains about it, say, well, Bhante Sujato said, just keep on going, all right? Don't force it. If your energy is falling off, okay, your energy is falling off. That happens. But as long as your energy is good, and as long as you can, you just keep on going with that. Eventually, what happens is that it gives rise to what we call the Patibhaga Nimitta. Okay, so this is the technical Pali jargon. I do this for in case anybody's familiar with the Pali jargon. So you know what I'm talking about. The Patibhaga Nimitta, they often translate as the counterpart sign, sometimes the reflex sign. If you're familiar with Ajahn Brahm's teachings, this is what he calls the Samadhi Nimitta, yeah? The proper Nimitta of Samadhi or breath meditation is the Patibhaga Nimitta. And in Metta meditation, like in breath meditation, the Patibhaga Nimitta appears, it'll appear more or less suddenly, yeah? It appears like at a definite point in time, even though you'll be gradually building up, and the strength of your meditation, the strength of the feeling and the nimitta will gradually be building up. But then there'll come a point when all of a sudden it's like this new thing steps into the arena. And this new nimitta is like it's like the sun which reveals itself to you for the first time. It's like the only light you've ever seen in your life is a far-off moon glimpsed through the trees and the clouds, and then suddenly you step out into the full light of day. And what you thought before was brightness and a peace in the mind, you now realize that that wasn't really bright and peaceful. This is bright. And the power of the mind is being revealed to you for the first time. And you realize why. When people have these experiences, people say, I saw the face of God. Yeah? That is the face of God. That's what God looks like. Yeah? And that's what the Buddha said. You know, God is these Brahmas who get reborn because of the power of their samadhi and so on. That's literally, that's what God is like. And it's a feeling of infinite light, infinite peace, infinite love. And it manifests inside you like something you've never seen before. But feels like your own true home. Now, there's a slight difference here between breath meditation and metta meditation. If you're doing breath meditation, at that point when the nimitta arises, you don't do anything. Okay? You just completely let go, completely be still, and let the nimitta take over. That nimitta signifies the beginning of what we call upachara samadhi. And upachara samadhi, they often translate it as neighborhood concentration or access concentration. But actually, they're not very good translations. Neighborhood means, well, down the stairs, out onto the road, and along the road a bit, okay? Then that's kind of in your neighborhood, yeah? Access means the way you get there. So the access is like the road out the front, which sort of gets up to here. That's your access. That's not what upachara means. Upachara is actually a building term in Pali. In ordinary language, it means the front porch. Okay? So the upachara to this room here is the lobby at the front there. That's the upachara. It's not the road down the front and out the way and so on. That's a very important distinction. Yeah? Because if upachara meant access or neighborhood, it would mean, well, you're heading in the right direction, and if you keep going and turn left and turn right and then keep going and climb the stairs, then maybe you'll get where you're going. Upachara means you're in the front porch, and with one more step, you'll cross over and you'll be there. Yeah? So that's why I prefer the word threshold concentration. Yeah? Upachara really means you're on the threshold of jhana. Basically, pretty much everything that you've done is ready. And you're just about there. The only difference between that upachara state and the state of jhana is that in upachara, because the mind's not completely absorbed yet, the unification is not completely fulfilled yet. So if somebody was to snap their fingers, you'd still hear it. Yeah? Like you'd probably jump in your seat, yeah? If you it's still possible to think. You kind of probably wouldn't really think, but it's still possible. Yeah? And it's still, you know, possible for you to be distracted and to take your mind somewhere else. I mean, you wouldn't, but there's still that bit of flexibility. When you're in jhana, the mind's completely locked in. So it's just that kind of slight no man's land where you're sort of stepping out of this world, but you haven't quite stepped into the next world yet. This is the state of upachara. Now, in breath meditation, when you reach that point, you just don't do anything and just let the mind will either go into jhana. If the preparation has been done well enough, it'll go into jhana. If not, it will just stay there for a while and then gradually come back to normal. With metta meditation, then, according to the way Ajahn Chacchai teaches it, you've still got a little bit to do at that point. And that little bit is to spread out loving kindness to all beings. And you do that at this point by, for the first time, expanding your mind outside of your body. So you still have a residual leftover sense of your body. And you can still use the words of metta. They're just there, just to direct your mind just a little bit. And so you just go outside of your body. May all beings in this room be happy. May all beings in Singapore be happy. And just go out across the whole world. May all beings in Asia be happy. May all beings in the world be happy. May all beings be happy. And as you do that, you feel your mind expanding. So this is not like sort of sending metta to this person or that person or this person or the other person, but it's allowing your consciousness to expand. And you actually feel it growing. And you realize that this is what the Buddha was talking about. Now, that's what the Buddha meant when he talked about a mind which is released, when he talked about a mind which has grown great, when he talked about a mind that's measureless. Because at this point, When the nimitta has arisen in this fourth stage, you finally achieve that goal of metta meditation, that goal of literally loving your enemies. And what that the word they use in Pali to describe that is the word sima sambheda, which means to the breaking down of the barriers. And the breaking down of the barriers means that if you place that oneself, a loved one, the neutral person and the disliked person, okay? And then the prison guard comes and says, well, we're going to have to chop someone's head off. Who is it going to be? Yeah? Classic dilemma. Sima sambheda means you can't make any difference between them. But it means that in a very profound way, okay? It doesn't mean that you can sit there and think, oh, there's somebody who's neutral, there's somebody I love, there's somebody I dislike, and there's myself, and I can't make up my mind between them, okay? That's not what it means. What it means is that the very possibility of thinking of people in these terms doesn't exist in your mind anymore. It's just been wiped clean. It's just not there anymore. The thoughts, disliked, neutral, loved, anything like that, it's just gone. Yeah, it's just swept away, and so that completely universal loving kindness, you're ready finally to take that out and spread that to all beings gradually across the whole cosmos. It doesn't matter, my best friend, my worst enemy, doesn't matter who it is, they all come within that sphere of loving kindness. And so you expand the metta out to all beings, and then just kind of let go, and then let the mind do what it will. Sometimes, just like with breath meditation, if your preparation's been done well and if the mind's ready, then it will go into jhanas. If not, then it will stay there for a while. Can be for quite a while. Upachara samadhi can last for a long time. Sometimes, I mean, usually it would last for at least 20 to 30 minutes, but it can last for many hours, actually. Otherwise, if you go into jhana, of course, again, that will usually last for a significant period of time. Jhanas is not just a short thing, but jhanas will last for at least like half an hour or something like that, possibly for many hours, depending on how deep it goes. And then when you develop a skill in jhanas, then of course you can develop the ability to determine previously how long you want to go into that and to withdraw from it. But at the moment we're just talking about being able to develop it. So at that point, when you develop the mind to that point, then that's when you really learn the meaning of letting go. Yeah, that's when you really let go of the world. Yeah, the Buddha said jhanas are on the end of the world. And so everything you've ever known, you think about it, sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, thought, memory, all of these things, gone. Yeah, and so that takes a lot of courage to let go of that. So sometimes at that point there'll be a lot of fear. Sometimes when the mind's about to go into concentration, it'll be terrified. Yeah, it will happen in different ways. People will experience it in different ways. So for some people, it's like a sort of mind going out like that. Some people, it's like dropping down a well. Some people, it's like sort of disappearing down a tunnel. So it can happen in many different ways. But at that point, you just have to let go and you just have to trust whatever that experience is. If something happens to get in the way, if you get disturbed or if you get excited or if you get fearful, the mind will drop back, the concentration will drop back, and you have to start again. Oh well. You have to be patient. Okay, so that's enough talking for now. Let's do some guided meditation and let's see who can get into jhanas. Well, we're only going to do a 20-minute guided meditation, so if you get into jhanas, you won't be able to follow the instructions, so that won't be any good. But so again, we're just doing this to give like a taste of like where the meditation's going. Yeah, so we have an idea of what we're going to be doing as we deepen the practice. So sitting quietly. Allowing the mind to settle. Not worrying about the past, not running off to the future. Staying still in the here and now. leaving the mind focused in the heart, say to oneself the words, may I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. Saying these words evenly, steadily, making a firm foundation for the mind. Notice that deep inside the heart, along with the words of metta, is something that's more subtle. It's the feeling of metta. It's a soft, gentle feeling of loving kindness. Gently hold that in the mind, keeping it safe, keeping it close. May I be happy, may I be happy, may I be happy. that feeling of metta spread out and fill up your whole body until every pore of your body is soaked and saturated full of loving kindness. From the top of your head down to the soles of your feet, from the hair on the skin through to the marrow of the bones. And moving to the second stage of metta, introducing the name of that loved person into the words of metta. May that loved one be happy. May that loved one be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. And then to the neutral person, may that neutral person be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. To the disliked person, may that disliked person be happy. May that disliked person be happy. May that disliked person be happy. Keeping the mind still, centered, focused. Not letting the mind think about that person. Not letting the mind wander off. Focusing. May that disliked one be happy. May they be happy. May they be happy. gradually taking the metta out to all beings, starting with feeling the mind spread out from the body, expanding out to fill this room. May all beings in this room be happy. May all beings in this room be happy. May all beings in this room be happy. Letting the mind go out further. May all beings in this street be happy. May all beings in this street be happy. May all beings in this street be happy. And then further still, may all beings in Singapore be happy. May all beings in Singapore be happy. May all beings in Singapore be happy. May all beings in Asia be happy. May all beings in Asia be happy. May all beings in Asia be happy. May all beings in the world be happy. May all beings in the world be happy. May all beings be happy. May all beings be happy. Letting the mind spread and radiate without limit, without boundary. Over the entire world. Now coming near the end of the meditation. May all beings in the world be happy. May all beings in Asia be happy. May all beings in Singapore be happy. May all beings in this street be happy. May all beings in this room be happy. Bringing the mind back into the body, may that disliked one be happy. And back through each stage, may that neutral person be happy. May the loved one be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. May I be happy. Letting the words of metta go. letting the feeling of metta fade away and allowing the mind to come back to a neutral space, empty, open, clear. And finally, take a minute to reflect on how that meditation's gone, inquiring into cause and effect. What just happened? How did I use my mind? What did those stages of meditation feel like? What was it like when I developed metta for a neutral person? What was it like to develop metta for the disliked one? What was it like when we spread metta out to all beings? And finally, what's my mind like now compared to how it was at the start of the meditation? And to end, we can dedicate the merit of our practice. May all beings be happy. May all beings be well. May all beings finally realize Nibbana. Sadhu, sadhu, okay, so was that fun? I enjoyed it anyway. Okay, so I've got some questions here. It looks like we had written questions for this evening. So I don't know if anyone has any. Maybe we'll read through some of the written questions and we'll see if anybody has any other pressing questions. About the practice we've just done. Anyway, I'll start with doing some of these written ones. Okay. For this question, why is there no such thing as good or bad meditation? Well, I think really the reason why, you know, we teach like that sometimes is because a lot of the times when people in meditation, the main obstacle to meditation is the judging mind, yeah? And we sort of want to go in and we use the same kind of competitive, comparing, judging mind in meditation as we used in worldly life. And so if we want to say that this is good meditation or this is bad meditation, then it's just more of an obstacle, it doesn't actually help anything. So actually, you know, then we emphasize, it doesn't really matter as long as you're doing the meditation. A lot of times people, you know, have a meditation, maybe they have a lot of anger or a lot of sleepiness and so on, and they feel quite depressed. They say it's bad meditation and they feel like giving up. Yeah? So just it's not helpful to think of it like that. Actually, the reality of it is that it's usually within the so-called bad meditations that we do most of the work. Yeah, this is the thing, you know. It's like, you know, which kind of field does the gardener work in? Is it the field where the fruit is all growing and ripe and dropping off the trees? Or is it the field which is rocky and weedy and full of thorns? Yeah? Yeah, it's the field which is rocky and weedy and full of thorns that the gardener goes in. And they complain, what a terrible field. But of course, that's the one they're getting ready for being fertile in the future. So it's usually in the so-called bad meditations that we actually do the work, which fruits later in so-called good meditations. And it's in the so-called good meditations that we often get complacent and lazy and think, ah, now my meditations come together. Yeah, it's going to be easy from now on. And then the next one's bad again. So it's just not a very helpful way of thinking about it. Okay, so here's another one. Blah, blah, blah. Okay, so question, does misreading or mispronouncing the words of the sutta reduce the quality and effect of chanting the sutta? Well, that's a question after my own heart. I'm a bit of a Pali fundamentalist, really, and I don't like hearing people mispronounce the sutta, so I'll agree with that. I think if you mispronounce the suttas, definitely. I think the main thing is if you bring that attitude of care, and I think it really does help if you learn what the proper pronunciation is, and you use a sense of precision and care when you're pronouncing the suttas. I mean, it helps you to understand. It helps you to be able to recognize when they're, for example, in Pali, you often have similar words which may be like the same root or something like that, so it conveys the same meaning, but it appears in different forms in the language. And if you can recognize where the same roots are appearing in different ways, for example, then you can start to understand the language and understand the connections between the ideas a lot better. So I think taking care with the pronunciation is a good thing. Does writing or copying suttas as good substitute as chanting them? It's probably not as good, because when you're chanting, you're using your whole body. Actually, like speaking aloud, speaking orally, is the most natural use of language which we've evolved from, the most basic use in human culture. Yeah, every human culture, as far as I know, has speech, but not every culture has language. You know, so when we speak, it actually involves the whole kind of lungs and brain and the throat and the belly. Everything is used, so it's actually a whole body thing, and that all contributes. So it's all kind of muscle memory. So actually, this is why chanting is especially good. But still, writing and copying suttas is still good. Okay, so it's talking about in the little book we have here. Okay, it says here that there's the English wordings, translations of the sutta verses. Can we chant these English instead of the Pali? Yes, of course, you can, just in the normal way rather than in a musical way. Yeah, it's quite possible to chant the English, like we've been doing with the Metta Sutta. Of course, some people... I mean, one of the things, of course, with the Pali is people often like chanting the Pali. And, of course... Pali was designed, the text that we chant in Pali was designed right from the beginning to be recited. It's an oral literature. It's for the very purpose of reciting, so it's got all of those rhythms and so on, and that's the whole purpose of it, is to be recited. So I think, I personally like to encourage people to do the chanting in Pali, and it also means that it's more useful, because often you go to different temples and so on, and you'll find that, you know, pretty much everywhere, at least in the Theravadan world, that they're all chanting similar chants, and if you know the Pali, then you can join in. Whereas the English ones, they, well, everyone has a different translation, so it's not so handy. You know, if you're traveling to Thailand or Sri Lanka or something, or if you know the Pali chants, it's really nice to be able to go to the temple and to be able to join in with what everyone's doing. But yes, certainly if you want to chant in English, no problems. Okay, so this next question. Why do we need to show loving kindness to our enemy? We hated them because they hurt us. Ah, we're going to give them loving kindness so they hurt us again. Why don't we just leave them alone? Ah. The voice of pragmatism here. Well, you can just leave them alone, but... I mean, leaving them alone, I guess, is better than trying to get revenge on them. Yeah, so it's you could do worse things, but we want to try and transform our mind. We don't want to have any enemies. Yeah, we want to overcome that. And if you hate even one person, then those seeds of hatred are going to stay within you, and you don't know who next you're going to hate. So if they've hurt us, then we have to learn to forgive them. But I think this is a good point that's raised here, is if we just develop metta for them, are they going to hurt us again? And I think this is something that is important. We have to remember that just because we have metta, it doesn't mean that we're going to be fools. It doesn't mean we're going to be, you know, allow ourselves to be exploited and abused and manipulated and so on. And that's not having metta for yourself, if you're letting yourself be abused and hurt. So it doesn't mean you can't be strong. It doesn't mean you can't stand up for yourself. In fact, you should stand up for yourself out of metta for yourself, and also out of metta for the other one, the other person, because they're making bad karma if they're hurting you. Yeah. So out of metta for them, you know, you can protect, you can defend, you can say, listen, you can't do that if you need to. If something happening is very bad, if it's violence, then you can call the police. If it's something which is abusive or manipulative, then you can put a stop to it. You should still stand up for yourself, but just do that with kindness and trying to protect everybody involved, and not from the thought of trying to harm. Okay, so the next question. When we meditate, thought is said to be bad and mindful awareness is said to be good. But what's the difference between the two? How would one contemplate without thought? Okay, I don't know about thought being bad. Thought is... See, the reason we teach people to let go of thoughts in meditation is not because thought itself is bad. Actually, right thought is the second factor of the Noble Eightfold Path, isn't it? Yeah? Thought itself is neutral. It's just like a part of how the mind works. But the problem is that normally we don't have to be encouraged to think. At least I've never found that to be a problem when I'm teaching meditation, right? Nobody sits there and says, but you're telling me to get rid of this thinking mind, but I don't know how to think. I can only tell me to learn how to think first, and then I'll let go of the thinking mind. That doesn't seem to be a problem. Yeah, we know how to think. Yeah, so it's not that thought is bad, it's just that we need to learn what's beyond that. And so the difference between thought and mindful awareness, that's precise. The fact that somebody can ask that question is precisely why we need to go beyond thought. Yeah, because you'll only know what that means when you stop thinking. Yeah, when there's silence, you listen in the silence. That's mindful awareness. What's the mind doing when there's no thought? Right. Next one. When I read from your profile that you used to be a failed rock star. Can you tell us more about why you decided to join the Order of Monastics after thinking that music was your path for some time? Well, there's actually more similarities between being a budding indie musician and being a monastic than you might think. First of all, no money, right? No regular place to live. A wandering lifestyle. And, I used to do begging. Well, not begging. I used to do busking, yeah? So sort of go onto the street corner and put my guitar case down and play. It's a bit like going begging with your arms full, isn't it? Yeah? Playing a song. And, why I decided to become a monk. Problem with this, I get asked this question a lot, but the problem with the question is that it's either I either give a very short and inadequate answer or a very long, complicated answer, and I'm never quite sure exactly how long and complicated the answer should be. But anyway, let me just give the short answer for now, and the short answer is that actually I played music professionally for about 6 years, and even though I kind of joke and say I was a failed musician, well, I had my failures and successes and those kinds of things. But in a sense, I felt that I felt that I really had done those things that I'd wanted to do. Actually, had done quite a few things. You know, I played in big stadiums and arenas and these kinds of things, and made videos and made records and played with some great musicians and written songs and done toured around the country and all these kinds of things. And so I knew what that was like. And I knew that, well, I could keep on doing that and that would be okay. But somehow it wasn't satisfying for me anymore. Somehow I knew that I wanted something else. And I didn't know what. So anyway, to make a long story short, I left everything behind. I went to Thailand. And when I went to Thailand, actually, I had $1,000 with me. And I was planning to stay there for a year. So $1,000 is not very much for a year. It's like $3 a day. And I could actually live on that much pretty much in Thailand. I actually got some work while I was there playing music and doing some other things, so I managed to help it along a bit. But everything was gone. Like, that's one of the good things about when you're traveling, is because everything has been left behind. Everything's completely open. Yeah. And so when I went to the monastery and meditated, I knew that that was something that was just far more profound than anything that I'd experienced before, and I knew that I just wanted to live, that's what I wanted to do for the rest of my life. So when I came to the monastery, it seemed, well, obvious, that's what the Buddha wanted us to do. Yeah? I tried meditating in the lay life and failed, so I'll go and become a monk instead. Okay, next one. If you're in an angry state of mind, will metta meditation help to counteract the negative feeling? Or you're not supposed to do metta meditation when you're angry? Okay, as a general rule, yes, it's best to avoid doing metta meditation at that time when you're actually feeling, you know, like a strong anger. Okay, if it's a little bit of annoyance or whatever, then never mind. But if you're feeling angry, best to just wait, try to be mindful, try to let go of the anger. And then when that's mostly gone or completely gone, then you do the metta and to try to stop it from re-arising. If you try to do the metta while you're angry, you'll end up kind of trying to paste the metta on top of the anger, and it doesn't really work. It maybe just gets more tense than anything else. Okay? Actually, if you have like a strong angry feelings and you want ways to help to be able to let go of it, I haven't actually talked much about that during this retreat, but that's one area where the Visuddhimagga is terrific, actually. If you have a look in the Visuddhimagga, it's translated as Path of Purification. And actually, we looked for it earlier, and I was surprised that there didn't seem to be any copies around. But there's actually a lot of translated copies around the place. And on the section under Metta Meditation, it's got a long section on different ways of abandoning anger through using different kinds of reflections and so on. And so there's a lot of actually very useful tips, and it gives you so many different ways you can use to abandon anger. By the time you've tried them all, I'm sure you will have forgotten what you were angry about in the first place. Okay, so if I can't get the metta by saying, may I be happy, can I start off by wishing, may my pet dogs be happy? Sure, do whatever you like, I don't care. I'll just give up trying to teach meditation. You can just do whatever you want, all right? Okay, so look, as I've been saying before, you know, we teach the framework as it's a support. It's there to try to help you, yeah? But the main thing is the feeling of metta. So if whatever you can do to help the feeling of metta to grow is good. But once the feeling is there, then we want to develop it. So that's the main thing that the metta meditation can do, is the framework can do, is to help you to develop the feeling of metta, okay? As far as actually giving rise to the feeling, it's very personal. So you have to find the way that's going to work for you. Okay. Is the act of renouncing to become a monk or a nun considered to be a selfish act? Well, it depends who you ask, of course, doesn't it? Some people think it's very selfish. How does one draw the line of filial piety to one's parents, especially in a Chinese traditional family, and commitment to one's spouse and family? Goodness. How am I supposed to know where you draw the line of filial piety in a Chinese family? Well, you should tell me, where do you draw the line? Ajahn Brahm, when at the conference in Jakarta, Ajahn Brahm said it's bad karma for parents to stop their parents from, to stop their children from ordaining. I don't think it quite says that, but yeah, it's certainly, yeah, it's not regarded as a good thing. What about the opposite case? What do the children do when their parents want to ordain? Yeah? We were in Ipoh recently, and when I, because you know, I lived in Ipoh for more than a year, in this monastery there. And originally I lived there, as it happens, because my mother was living in Ipoh. She married married someone who's living in Ipoh. So I went there to visit her, and I ended up staying in this temple there. And of course, all the you know, all the people who come to the temple always ask me, you know, what does your mother think about you being ordained? And she's actually very happy about it. If you're interested, that one of my friends, Judy Chua, did an interview with her, and we published it in the Eastern Horizon magazine. So that was a few years ago now. So they wanted to do an interview with me, and I said, why don't you interview my mum instead? So actually, it was really nice. Yeah. So that was good. But this time it was interesting because we went back to the same monastery where I'd been. And I was there with Venerable Hasapanya, one of the bhikkhunis who ordained in Perth. And her son was there in the audience. Yeah. And so because I knew her and her family, actually her family used to be the main dayakas at that monastery. So when I was staying there 10 years ago, they used to come every day and bring dana. So I knew them all very well. And that was the time she decided to go forth. And she'd actually become a mother quite young. I think she was about 18 or something like that when she had her first child, her first and only child. She said that she really loved children. So, you know, she got married quite young and had her first son. And after that, she decided that she didn't want to have any more ever. And so when I knew her, the son was about 18 and he was going to college. And he was quite happy about it. He said, you know, Mum, if you want to become a nun, you go off and become a nun. The husband wasn't so happy. Although I saw he was there as well at the temple. So, yeah, they asked him, you know, how do you feel about your mum being a nun? And he said he was very proud. Yeah. So it was really sweet to see that. So, you know, really, parents shouldn't be kind of threatened or kind of worried if their children want to ordain. It actually is a beautiful thing to want to ordain, and it's a bigger life. You know, you get the ordination is like a calling out to a higher way of living, a higher set of values, and there's nothing to be afraid of. Yeah, there's nothing to be afraid of. Technically, no. No. In according to the Vinaya, yeah, the youngest is if you're young enough to scare a crow, then you can take a novice ordination. So they usually say 7 for novices and 20 for full ordination. But as far as the upper age limit goes, there's no particular upper age limit. So in some monasteries, it depends where you are, then the monasteries will have policies about that. So they might say they don't ordain anyone over a certain age. But according to Vinaya, there's no particular age limit. Yeah. Okay, what else we got? Okay, so here's a question about someone saying that their mum doesn't have is not peaceful while they're sleeping. That they're often talking when they're asleep and so on. And they say she told us that she was always dreams of people who've passed away. I'm just trying to read this here. I think gods and devils. So she has dreams of gods and devils. And she doesn't have good sleep. We're doing metta meditation. If we dedicate the metta meditation to her, will that help her to sleep better? And how should we go about that so that help her to sleep? Okay. So doing metta meditation is the meditation which the Buddha recommended for being able to sleep well. And, of course, that's in the Metta Nisangsa Sutta, the 11 benefits of Metta meditation. And so that's always recommended before you go to bed, is to do a bit of Metta meditation. I'm not sure how much it's going to do for somebody else. If you do the Metta meditation and dedicate it for them, well, it can't hurt. You can try it and see, but I'm not sure whether that will work. To get better, I mean, certainly to, as a general piece of advice, to do some Metta meditation before going to sleep is a good thing. But whether you can do that and dedicate it to your mum, give it a go and see how it goes. That's all I can say. Okay, so somebody's seeing shadows in their house. Okay, so some black or white shadows in my house. It just disappears when I see them. That image is there and the image disappears in the next moment. Ooh, I don't know. Until I go to your house, I can see whether there's anything lurking around there. Most likely just your imagination, I would guess. But, I can't say whether there'd be anything more to it than that. Okay, so that's all the written questions I think we have. I still have any more questions before we wrap up for this evening?
Can I just clarify about that metta feeling? You mentioned earlier that we should hold on to that feeling as long as possible before we transfer it to a person we love. The thing is that we are so new to this meditation, we don't know how long the feeling is going to last. So is it better to have the feeling, and once you get the feeling, give it to the person you love and then come back and see how long it can go on? Thanks.
No, just keep on holding on to it. Don't worry about it. Yeah. Don't worry, just stay there. Just the more you be peaceful, the more you be content. Yeah. The feeling will look after itself. Metta will look after itself. Yeah? Just be peaceful. Yeah.
But at some point in time, we have to pass it on to the one we love, right?
Mm, yeah.
So even if the feeling has become very weak, it's okay?
Well, as a general rule of thumb, yeah, if we're going from the first stage to the second stage, metta for oneself, and then going to metta for the loved one, if the metta for oneself is through your whole body, yeah, even and sustained, and you keep that awareness in your mind for 10, 20 minutes or so, and then you're ready to go to the metta for the loved person.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, so that's the general rule. But as I said, you know, obviously it doesn't hurt to do it, you know, other ways. But that's the best way of doing it. Okay. Anyway, go on. Yes.
Achan, I have a little difficulty with knowing what's happiness. As in, when you say, "May I be happy," I do not know what does it mean to be happy. So I keep thinking of it in terms of what it is not. For example, if I'm not angry, then I should be happy. Or if I'm not jealous, then that is happiness. Is that the correct way of defining it?
No.
So what does it mean to be, may I be happy?
Well, see, the problem is, the reason why I say no is because you can have an absence of jealousy, an absence of anger and so on. For example, you might have equanimity, right? A completely neutral feeling. I don't have any anger, I don't have any jealousy, I don't have anything else. But that's not happiness as such, yeah? So happiness is actually like a positive feeling. It's not just an absence. It's an actual presence of that feeling of pleasure. Yeah, that's what I'm talking about here. So it's an actual, in actually, in Buddhism, we talk about pleasant feeling or pleasure, vedana. Sorry, sukha, vedana, or sukha. We talk about sukha in many different ways, okay? So sukha, as in pleasure, can be, for example, nibbana is pleasure, yeah? But nibbana isn't a pleasant feeling, yeah? We know that. But what I'm talking about here, when I'm talking about sukha in meditation, that's what it is. It's a pleasant feeling, yeah? So it's an actually arisen feeling of pleasure which you can feel inside your body. Yeah?
Obviously, haven't reached there yet.
Hang on. Sorry, we've got a question down here.
I was just wondering if Bhante can clarify what do you mean by inside the body, like a feeling inside the body. Because you were mentioning yesterday that it's something tactile.
Uh-huh.
So is it something that you should be feeling like really like in your innards? Or is it something that's just the mind area?
No, you feel it in those parts of the body. You feel it as if it's right there in your knee or right there in your shoulder or whatever. It's part of that feel. Like when we're sitting, if you sit, you close your eyes, you feel where your body is at. You get like a feel, what they call proprioception, is the feedback from your body. It's part of that field of feedback of your body. It's actually there inside your body.
So I suppose transfer it from like a thought, kind of like, I feel hungry, kind of hungry feeling, kind of feeling, or is it like... I feel sad, and that sad is just like in your head, right? Let's say if you feel disappointed.
You see, sad isn't just in your head. Actually, if you sit and meditate and you look, the feeling of sadness, you feel in your belly, you feel in your heart, yeah? And actually, you can even see that. You know, if you see another person, you can see that they're kind of drooping. He has that great description in the Suttas of Mara when he's been defeated by the Buddha. He's sitting sad and dejected, his head's drooping, his shoulders are hanging, and he's scratching the ground with a stick. You know, it's this classic description. You know, just from his posture, actually the sadness, emotion, is embodied. Emotion is not something that just lives in the head. And that's something which is purely true on purely a physical level. Like somebody can test your bloodstream and they'll find endorphins and different kinds of things there which are present when there's happy feelings. It's actually chemically different, and the patterns of energy, the muscles, everything in your whole body is different when you have pleasure and pain, happy and sad emotions. So you're actually literally feeling it inside your body. Yeah? Of course, the experience is a mental experience. All experience is mental, of course, yeah? But you're feeling it located in your body.
That's only possible with mindfulness, right? Like, that you feel, okay.
Yeah. That's right. That's why we start out with the practice of mindful awareness, to locate your awareness in your body. Yeah. I'll come to you in a second. We've had another question at the back first.
Ajahn, the metta meditation that you just taught us, it seems like to complete the full session, it's going to take hours, take days. So what's your advice if, let's say, you want to practice a bit, let's say, half an hour, 15 minutes a day? How do you go about it?
Well, look, if for most people, if you're practicing half an hour a day, I would say stick to the first two stages, metta for yourself and for a loved person. And maybe if you just try to develop those as best you can. And if you feel you're really confident in developing those ones, then you can go on to develop metta for the other stages. If you want to develop metta more broadly in terms of, out to all beings and all of these kinds of things, then you could do that like at the end of the practice, yeah? So you can spend some time at the end of your meditation and go through, may Auntie Joan be happy, may Uncle Fred be happy, and go through everybody one by one, and metta to my dogs and my cats and the little worms in the ground, and you can go around all of those things. But if you try to do that in meditation, it just becomes too complicated. Yeah? So that's complicating the mind. So just keep the actual main meditation as doing metta usually for yourself, and also maybe for a loved person if you want to. And then you can do the metta spread metta to whatever afterwards. Okay? And if you know, if you find that the meditation is going really well, and you do those two stages, and you feel that metta is really strong and so on, then by all means try and go further. But you know, to develop samadhi at a deeper level, then yes, you're going to have to sit for longer than half an hour or so a day. I mean, usually, that's what I was talking about this evening, of developing up to the Paribhaga Nimitta, the fully developed metta Nimitta. Usually, you know, when you're developing it, you'll sit for maybe 2 or 3 hours before that Nimitta will arise. So if you can't sit for that long, then you've got to sort of keep on developing the concentration. That's not by forcing yourself to sit for that period, but that's just naturally the length of concentration will grow. Yes.
When you said we develop the metta from one stages to another, let's say we have the metta sort of like fade, do we go back to the previous stage, or we just start from the same stage?
Sorry, when you have the metta, I missed the word
from
there.
From one stage to another, let's say from ourselves to a loved one and then to a neutral person, let's say the metta sort of like fade when you go to the neutral. So you go back to the previous stage, or you start from the beginning?
Okay, that's a good question. Yeah, so if you reach a certain stage and then the metta falls back, yeah, and it's not so strong, either way is fine. You can come back to the previous stage of metta. Okay, so let's say if you go up to the neutral person, and then you find after doing that for a few minutes that the metta is falling away and you can't keep the same energy for the neutral person, you can come back to the loved person. And if you find that on that second stage that the metta will return, then that's fine. Just keep on developing that, make that stronger and stronger, and then try again to go back to the third person and so on until you know how strong it needs to be. If it's still at the second stage is not working, then come back to the first stage and then try that. If that's still not working, then you know you can finish that meditation for that period. And so, but if once you do that, then a number of times, then you'll know when you're ready to reach those different stages. So that's why it never hurts to try it out. You know, you can try these different stages. If it works, that's good. If it doesn't work, that's just telling you that you're not ready yet. So you come back, develop it more at one of the lower stages.
Okay. And then for the neutral person, can it be someone that you don't know but you admire, let's say Bhante Ji, for example, or someone already deceased but you're not personally attached, like Ajahn Chah, for example?
Probably best not. Yeah, that's not quite what the neutral person is. Yeah. It's best to just like an ordinary person who you know a bit, but not too much. Yeah.
Okay, thank you. Ajahn, I have a question pertaining to the practice we're doing just now. Now, when we were going from the different stages, when we go on the metta meditation from beings along the street, and then expanding further and further, I can feel that I may not be too ready when I can actually feel constriction on this side of the ribs. Does that mean that I'm not ready to the next stage? I have to go back. And then when we go expand out, and then when we go back to the self, I actually felt lighter and lighter, and I actually feel the sense of light. So does it mean that when I go extend out and when I'm not ready, there's some kind of heaviness? Does that mean?
Maybe, yeah probably. It's hard to generalize when, you know, just on basis of one short meditation. But yeah, look, I mean, it seems to be indicating that you're more comfortable to come back to those earlier stages, which of course makes sense because we're just beginning out in the meditation. So yeah.
So, what do you advise?
Oh, like I said before, stick with the first two stages most of the time, unless you feel really confident and really solid and want to try, or else maybe you just feel like being a daredevil and leaping off into the unknown. Yeah.
Thank you.
looks like it's getting a little bit late this evening. So, what's happening tomorrow? Okay, so tomorrow morning, early morning meditation for those staying over. Those who are going back home, be back again by 8:30. And morning session will be similar to previous, and we'll have the closing session at 11 o'clock, just before lunch.